This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, they say three times a charm. I don't know what's going on. I think it's a gremlin issue this morning. But the guys have put on their gremlin spike shoes. They're going to get rid of all those gremlins. Patrick Madrid here starting the show, and my number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Plenty to talk about, including my talking to you. So don't be shy. Give a call, 888-914-9149. How would you feel if your child came home from school and said, "Mommy, the teacher said that 2 plus 2 equals 4 is actually a form of white supremacy." And you'd say, "Oh, come on, nobody can be that ridiculous." And your child says, "Yes, Mommy, that's what they taught us in school today." Well, listen to this. This actually happens, and it's not like just at the grammar school level. The Washington Examiner has an article about a math education professor in New York City who claims that the equation 2 plus 2 equals 4, quote, reeks of white supremacist patriarchy. I bet you never saw the patriarchy coming in the 2 plus 2 equals 4 equation, did you? When you were a little kid and you were learning your sums, as they say in England, you were learning how to add, did you ever stop and think that this was actually perpetuating the patriarchy, and that by writing down 2 plus 2 equals 4, you became a puppet of the patriarchy? The idea, this according to Brooklyn College professor of math education, Lori Rubel, she tweeted last week to 1,200 followers on Twitter, the idea that math or data is culturally neutral or in any way objective is a myth. And the word myth is in caps. I'm ready to move on with that understanding. Who's coming with me? You could just picture her like in the trenches of some fierce battle during World War II. And she's going to bravely leap out of the trench with her flag to strike a blow for equality. Who's coming with me? Are you coming with me? Because I'm going over there. Because 2 plus 2 equals 4, she says, reeks of white supremacist patriarchy. Along with the, of course, math is neutral because 2 plus 2 equals 4 trope, are the related and creepy. By the way, the word creepy is way overused nowadays. It's sort of been drained of its meaning, if you ask me. Everything is creepy. Oh, that's creepy, or this is creepy, or he's creepy. It sort of doesn't mean anything anymore. Anyway, she's using it in that way. So let's begin. I know you probably already have a headache, and it's too early to have a headache on a Wednesday morning, but we'll press through this, and I'll give you an Excedrin. Along with the, of course, math is neutral because 2 plus 2 equals 4 trope. This is her speaking. Are the related and creepy, math is pure and protect math. It reeks of white supremacist patriarchy. I'd rather think on nurturing people and protecting the planet with math in the service of them goals. I'm just reading what she wrote here. That's all she wrote. In fact, that's not all she wrote. 888-914-9149. The tweets grabbed the attention of others within academia, including Harvard PhD candidate Kareem Carr, who said, quote, "People say it's subjectivism to ask if math is Western. I don't get that. It's an objective fact that some groups were more evolved in the creation of modern math than others. They may have been trying to make it objective, but it's not stupid to ask if they actually succeeded." One academic, James Lindsay, pushed back against Rubel's tweet, saying that the simple math equation 2 plus 2 equals 4 helped lead to significant scientific feats, saying, quote, this is on Twitter, "It's certainly the case, and the woke need to be held firmly to the point that feats of engineering like space travel and rocketry utterly depend upon accepting stable meanings of mathematical statements like 2 plus 2 equals 4 as objectively true, not mere accidents of culture." Rubel's tweets, this is the wacky teacher, Rubel's tweets come after Rutgers University's English department declared that proper grammar is racist earlier this summer. You may remember when I shared that with you earlier this year. If you use proper grammar, then that's racist. Now, it's interesting because that earlier tweet talks about, where did it go? in service of them goods, which, of them goals. I think that was, that was Professor Rubel. So there's an example, I guess, of intentionally misusing the language to show that you're not a racist. So I guess the way the rules work now is that if you use the English language correctly, you're a racist and probably patriarchal, probably a puppet of the patriarchy. And if you don't use the English language correctly, then you are, I don't know, what does that make you? Does that make you invulnerable to criticism because you're one of the people? And here's another question, as long as I'm at it, since these people are in academia, what if you were to go get or go try to get, say, a bachelor's degree in Spanish or a master's degree in Spanish or maybe even a PhD in some language, let's say Russian or Chinese? Do you think you would actually get the diploma? Do you think you'd actually get the degree? Could you pass tests and show proficiency if you intentionally didn't speak the language correctly? And instead of speaking correct, fluent Russian or Chinese or what have you, you intentionally mangled it. For what purpose? You would not get that degree. You would not get your PhD. They would say, why don't you go back like to, you know, undergraduate level and just like relearn, take a remedial course so you'll know how to speak the language and then come back and see if you want to pursue a PhD. The school's English department, this is Rutgers, by the way, they're altering its grammar. They're altering their grammar standards to stand with and respond to Black Lives Matter movement. And the department's head said that the program will hold, quote, workshops on social justice and writing and increase the focus on graduate student life and incorporate critical grammar into our pedagogy. Critical grammar simply means bad grammar. You know, ain't. Did your mom ever tell you, don't say ain't. We ain't going with you. And your mom probably when you were young, don't say that. That's not correct English. So they're doing that. And I wanted you to be aware of it because that's the kind of mindset that is seeped into so many areas of academia. It's everywhere. And maybe you're in academia. Maybe you are, you know, in that world and you'd like to share with me a story of what, you know, happened in your situation. The number is 888-914-9149. Now, on an unrelated matter, you know the Dear Abby type columns where you get advice? This one caught my eye because it was so over the top. At first I thought it might be a parody, but here's the question. This is from the New York Times. They have an ethicist columnist. In other words, the ethicist columnist will tell you in answer to your question whether what you're doing is right or wrong. So here's the question that was posed to the ethicist columnist in the New York Times. A man romanced my daughter for a green card. Should I report him? Sounds like a Seinfeld episode. So here's the question. I'll read it to you verbatim from the New York Times. My adult daughter met a nice man. They went for a hike. He brought along a man from an Eastern European country here on a work visa. There was chemistry between my daughter and this man, and they started spending time together. The original guy immediately stepped aside. I've got to step in right now and just say, as a father, I would be saying to my daughter, what on earth do you think you're doing going hiking in some who knows where remote place with two men that you don't know? Don't do that. That would be the first mistake, the first problem that I, as the daddy ethicist, would tell my daughter. Okay, so the original guy steps aside. She meets this guy, doesn't know him, nice guy. Hey, let's go on a hike. Okay. Oh, by the way, I'm bringing along another man. So two men, one woman, alone, presumably, hiking somewhere. The first guy that she just met, he departs once he introduces her to the second guy. Does this already sound weird to you? I mean, can you fathers picture yourselves allowing your 20-year-old daughter or your 19-year-old daughter to go and do thus? I can't. So fast forward, this is the person asking the question. Fast forward, after a particularly fun hike and dinner, the Eastern European said, they. Now you see, I have to pause again. This is intentional. Rather than saying the second man or the Eastern European man, they did say that a couple of times in the first paragraph, but I think they want to get away from that as much as possible. So then they fall back on this gender neutral language, the Eastern European, okay, said they would like to see her again. And that in this case, it is correct that they should plan a backpacking trip. They appeared to be on the path toward love, and my daughter was very happy. The next day, he asked her to marry him so he could get a green card. This is the day after the hike. She was stunned and hurt. He was artless in his response to her, and then he ghosted her, which, as I understand it, Cyrus is not here to help me with cultural nuances, but as I understand it, ghosting means where maybe you meet somebody, you go out for a cup of coffee or a date or something, and then rather than let the other person down and say, I don't want to do that anymore, you, by ghosting them, correct me if I'm wrong, but ghosting means that you just disappear. You don't return texts, you don't respond, you're just gone. Let's see. So he says, my daughter is licking her wounds and embarrassed to have fallen for this scam. I am not normally a meddlesome mom, but this was cruel. He's in the United States strictly for financial reasons. His country is peaceful but poor, and he's part of the brain drain that is crippling their economy. I want to turn him into immigration because we have ample homegrown jerks. Where's this anger coming from? We have ample homegrown jerks and don't need to import more. And also because his work is a high-paying blue-collar job, we probably don't need to bring in workers to do. Does that make her a racist? Should I let it drop or just report him? Okay, so that's the question that's posed to the ethicist. Here's the ethicist's response. In your account, he's trying to make a go of it in our rich country to gain prospects unavailable to him back home. What he saw in your daughter was a chance to secure permanent residency and move ahead with that plan. If you report him and the government finds that in the statutory language, he attempted, this is a quote from the statute, that if it finds that he attempted or conspired to enter into a marriage for the purpose of evading the immigration laws, he could be removed from this country and deemed permanently inadmissible. Those who arrange sham marriages as a business can face prison. Even if you think, the ethicist says, even if you think these statutes exist for a sound reason, in taking it upon yourself to bring down the full weight of the law, you will have radically reduced his prospects in a vindictive manner. The state has its own aims in establishing legal penalties. Your aim is clearly to punish this man for hurting your daughter. You mention more public-minded reasons for turning him in. You say that he's a jerk, but you have a very limited basis on which to judge his overall character. And even if he is, in some respects, a jerk, you can't take seriously thinking reducing the number of jerks in the United States by one is a contribution to our national welfare. I honestly have never thought of it that way. Let's reduce the population of jerks. That's what she's basically saying. I'd never thought of it that way. How would you quantify that population? I don't think the census asks that question. They don't check off a box when they're doing the census visit, as far as I know, anyway. And the ethicist says, and though you refer to his expatriation as a loss to his home country, brain drain, you don't suggest that the country in question is hard up for blue-collar workers with this particular skill, or indeed would benefit from reclaiming a jerk. What about your observation that he's doing a job that could be done by an American? First, the impact of immigrant labor can't be reduced to a one-to-one effect like this. Increasing our workforce flexibility can help companies grow and create jobs for other workers. Of course, there are debates among economists about how the welfare of American workers. I wonder if the person who wrote the original letter is even continuing to read it, because it's a little bit, substantive. A lot of information here. I think the ethicist says most would agree that immigration has increased America's total wealth, even if that wealth is unevenly distributed. There can be winners and losers. Yet these large policy issues don't tell us what a person should do when she has the power to get one immigrant deported. Your aim is to exact retribution. It isn't to advance the development of better policies in this area. I like the way this is sort of sliced and diced. To be sure, anyone who toys with your daughter's emotions out of self-interested calculation has done something reprehensible. But note that this person did at least come clean with her. He let her know what he was up to before she could commit herself in a more permanent way. And though it seems a safe guess that her affection wasn't fully reciprocated, we don't know that his affection was entirely feigned. One more thing. Whatever you do, shouldn't you ask your daughter what she thinks about all this before making a decision? The wrong that you're responding to was done not to you, but to her. What do you think? If your daughter, I'll just read it again, were in that situation. She meets a guy from another country. They kind of have a spark. They start to move, you know, within a day or so in the direction of wanting to see each other more. She really likes him. He says he really likes her. And then within 48 hours, he lets her know that he really mainly just wants to get her green card to stay in the United States. You may be saying, well, what would you do? Well, I wouldn't do what the mom was proposing to do. I wouldn't call the immigration authorities and turn this guy in. I would say to my daughter, however, under no circumstances should you pursue this relationship. I mean, thankfully, the guy was honest with you. Thankfully, he wasn't a mass murderer. Thankfully, he was at least decent enough to tell you. I mean, a lot of guys might never have told you, or at least never have told you before you got married, and then they got the green card, and then the next thing you know, they're walking out on you. So I think, if anything, the lesson here for the mom is, why are you so busy worrying about how you can retaliate against this guy when you got a lot of problems, it seems, in, you know, maybe your attitude toward your daughter and her welfare? Or so
yes,
it seems to me.
Yes, that's true.
It is true. It is true. So that would be my take on it. Turn your attention to your daughter and say, you know, how about if you don't go hiking with two guys you've never known before, and maybe pursue, if you're interested in a husband, pursue it in a way that's going to likely yield you a crop of qualified candidates. Speaking of which, before we take our break, the number again, 888-914-9149. There are some books out there that I like to recommend, written by Steve Wood. Dads.org is his website, but they're carried at your local Catholic bookstore. And I have no connection to these whatsoever, but I really like them. And I've given them out to my young adult children when they were in that phase looking for partners. One is The ABCs of Finding a Good Husband, and that's written for the girls. And The ABCs of Finding a Good Wife, which is written for the boys. And they're two different books, same idea, same general approach to how do you look for somebody who would be an apt candidate for marriage. But obviously the content is going to be different, because what women are looking for in men is different from what men are looking for in women. There are some commonalities, of course, but there are a lot of things that are going to be different. So maybe you've got a college-age student, son or daughter, college-age son or daughter. Or maybe there's somebody in your life, could be your godson or goddaughter, and they're getting to that age now where they're starting to consider marriage. They might be old enough to start looking around. This would be the kind of thing that you can use to help guide them so that they don't wind up in the pages of the New York Times in the letter to the ethicist with mom asking, what do I do? It could save a lot of wear and tear. 888-914-9149. I'll be getting to your phone calls and plenty more when we come back from this quick timeout. You're listening to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
At the intersection of faith and culture, the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We're back. Let's get this roadshow on the road. The number is 888-914-9149. I'd love to talk to you. We have lines open right now. Let's start off with Joseph in Chicago. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, Patrick. We spoke before many times, and I just wanted to ask you, can the demons oppress and basically get a person to overthink something and react indifferent and perhaps in anger? Can that happen? Because I had an argument with my brother, who's coming in from Texas out of nowhere, and it was just, it went nuts, and it's been like 2 days now, and I'm thinking, where did that come from? And I don't know. I just don't know. It was a conversation we had, and then I thought I heard something, and I didn't give him a chance to explain, and then I blew up. I'm thinking, what happened? I don't get it. I am nowhere near evil. I go to church. I pray now. I mean, you remember my story, so it's been years now.
Yeah.
And I just don't know what happened, and I'm thinking maybe maybe the same thing's happening again, but this time it's in a different format to keep us apart, as it did happen when we were children, when we were altar boys and all that. I thought that then, that he wanted to separate and destroy the family, which he did. And I think that's happening again, but I don't know. Is that a possibility? Or am I just like over?
No, I think it is a possibility. And yet it may be more likely that, and I don't know, because, you know, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a counselor, mm-hmm. I don't have any training. So this is just, I'm just taking a shot here. I don't know for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if it could be just years of pent-up frustration under the surface on both your parts. I mean, what you just said a second ago is alarming. I mean, you just said that... I'm not saying this in an accusatory way. I'm just saying I picked up on what you said, that years ago you thought your brother was trying to destroy the family, and he was trying to destroy the family. I mean, that right there is a signal to me that whatever the bad blood has been over the years, being human beings, we have a tendency to store up things like anger and frustration. And sometimes they'll come out all of a sudden under the wrong circumstances. And so whatever the altercation was that you had with him might have been years and years and years in the making, and it just found a crack and out it came, and it came out forcefully. So it may be something entirely like that that has nothing to do with the evil one. So consider that. It's possible that, you know, old Hairy Legs was involved in some way, and an exorcist really would be one in a better position to dissect the specifics of that. But to answer your question, yeah, it's possible. But if I had to guess, Joseph, I'd say it's probably a lot less likely than the first scenario that I just suggested. What do you think?
I'm sorry to, I didn't mean to confuse anyone. My brother had nothing to do with the destruction of the family. What I should have said more clearly is when the priest assaulted us sexually, that destroyed our family.
Oh, now I get
separated.
It. Okay.
Yeah, and now we're trying to get back together, and all of this, no, it's my mistake, it's my phone, it's cell tower, it's sort of raining, and lately, when I want to find out something of God, it acts this way, it starts making these weird noise.
Well, let me jump in again, if I may, Joseph. So you just reminded me, in fact, of that horrible chapter in both of your lives. I hadn't remembered that part of it, so thanks for adding that in. See, there too, now you have another... So we can eliminate the other possibility, because what I thought I heard you say, you didn't say. But you both came through the horrors of childhood sexual abuse by a priest and everything that that would entail. So it just seems not very unlikely that this is just a lot of emotion, frustration, fear, anger. Who knows what emotions are swirling around inside the human mind, but those things came out in a weird way all of a sudden, forcefully. And if I had to guess, I think it's probably just that and not demonic interference. Now, I know I'm repeating myself, but maybe it's worth repeating. This is not to say that maybe there is some diabolical activity, in which case, obviously, if you think it rises to the level where you might need some prayers of deliverance, get in touch with the diocesan exorcist and see if it's possible to meet with him. And maybe he can help you sort through that. But chances are the issue is more rooted in the experiences that you and your brother had, and both of your...
So it's basically me. It's just being human. It's most likely it's just, like you said, the pent-up frustration of the past. We've been separated for a long time after that. I mean, it did destroy the family. I took off. Yeah. Johnny, he did his thing. And sometimes I want this to work with my brother so much, and I just don't know why I exploded like that. And it's just really strange. And I thought, well, that's generally not how I talk with him.
Have you apologized yet? Has that happened?
I did. I texted him, and he said he'll call me back, and I cut him off when he was explaining things. But it was just, it came from nowhere. It came from the depth of my stomach, and it just came out of my mouth. And it really bothers me, because I don't want to speak this way, because I know sanctity must happen. I cannot speak and treat people rudely or excoriate them. I cannot do that. And I don't want to, and I don't want to get in trouble, and I want sanctity, and I just don't know where it came from. And it blows my mind, really. It just blows my mind, but it probably is what you said. It's probably a human disposition, and I'm just a human, and I just overreacted, and I did apologize, and I will grovel even more.
Yeah, that's good. There are plenty of proverbs and other passages in Scripture that talk about the importance of governing one's tongue. And boy, it's not easy, that's for sure. I'll read you a few of them. This one is very, very to the point. There is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. So we can use our speech in different ways, both for good and for bad. Proverbs 21:23 says, "Whoever keeps his mouth and his tongue keeps himself out of trouble." And then a classic passage from the Epistle of St. James, chapter 1, "If anyone thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue but deceives his heart, this person's religion is worthless." So, and then, of course, Jesus talks about how it's not what goes into a man that makes him defiled, but what comes out of his mouth that makes him defiled. Now, I'm not saying any of those things to bring you down, Joseph, or to make you feel worse than you already do. But it's a good reminder for all of us that even in those moments where you feel overpowered by a desire to say something, almost always the best thing to do is to clamp it shut and try to ride out the storm and then rethink what you want to say, and it'll come out better later. Well, my hope is that you and your brother can get back on track, and sometimes maybe more than a text might be necessary. If you can tell him in person how you feel about this and how you're sorry, that would be great. If not, maybe an email or something a little bit more, something a little bit more than a text. Because, you know, texting is nice, it's convenient, but it doesn't convey the same amount of personal touch. Hang in there, Joseph, hang in there. And I admire you for seeking holiness the way you do. Every time I talk to you, I come away from our conversation realizing how intent you are upon that. Let's go now to Dave in Sonoma, California, home of the last California mission, if you're going north. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Proud to be the place of the last California mission. So.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I was with you on your pilgrimage, Mindy, in 2016, where we ended our pilgrimage here in Sonoma with you. So great time.
Oh, yeah.
What a wonderful time that was.
We had a great time. Our friends at Canterbury Pilgrimages, they did such a great job with that pilgrimage. And I remember that. That was before the fires that struck that area shortly after that, right?
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. So, yes. So a couple of, oh gosh, it might have been even more than a month ago, we listen to your show every morning and we're on our way to Mass, and somebody had called in and wanting to know the difference between a contraceptive mentality in using natural family planning. And I was driving in the car and you made a statement about how that is different. And it was just brilliant. And I said, oh, I have to remember that. That is just a brilliant statement. And of course, I couldn't remember what it was. And I went to your website.
No
problem. I'm racking all the resources I have, and so I thought I'm just going to call him and see if he remembers that brilliant statement he made. Oh,
thank you for your kind words. Well, I think I remember what I was talking about on that call. And by the way, if you go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, the search bar should pull up that program for you if you do a keyword search by NFP, contraception, contraceptive mentality, any of those kinds of keywords should find it. But in any case, my recollection is that I was using the comparison between practicing natural family planning and NFP for short, which is where the married couple, they abstain from the marriage act for a period of time during the wife's fertile time during the month. And I was comparing it, if I remember correctly, with fasting from food and how, on the one hand, if you were to misuse the good of food by eating it gluttonously and maybe binging and purging, you eat all the food and enjoy it and it tastes great, then you go in the other room and you barf it all back up again, that's a misuse of a good thing. Fasting is not a misuse of a good thing. It's the refraining of using a good thing. So you don't eat, you don't receive the enjoyment from it, And then when the time of fasting is over, then you go back to eating again responsibly. So does that sound like the comparison that you remember me making?
Very, very well could be, because it sounded like a kind of a real life situation that people could relate to. And I think that's what you did.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. And in that case, as I recall, the question from the husband or the wife, I forget which, was about contraceptive mentality, where one would use NFP as a means to avoid conception forever or indefinitely without any willingness to have any children at all. And that's an area where there can be a real problem, where one of the things that the church requires, really God requires it, and that is that we be open to his plan for our lives. And his plan may well include procreation. And so if a couple were to get married in the Catholic Church and have no willingness whatsoever to have any children at any time, and I'm not talking about people who can't have children, but just people who don't want children but could if they wanted to, if they were to use the Marriage Act in a selfish way and create a barrier through contraception, say, to prevent any conception from taking place, that would be seriously wrong. And the other question had to do with, what if they're not doing that? What if they're not engaging in the marital act in an irresponsible way like that? But what if they're just avoiding during the times of fertility? What if they're just avoiding this? Could that also be bad? So anyway, does that sound like what you're thinking of?
That I think you hit it out of the park.
Okay. I appreciate it. Well, thank you, Dave. I appreciate
that. Thank you so much, Patrick. I appreciate it. Great talking with you.
You're most welcome. And looking forward to the next pilgrimage we can take once life gets back to normal. 888-914-9149. We'll take a break and come back with more. A line just opened up, so if you want to be on the air with me and ask a question, now is the time to dial 888-914-9149. I've got some UFO news, believe it or not. Some more information about UFOs. Do you think they're real? Or do you think this is all fakery? Or do you think these are demons, as some people claim, who are trying to trick us? I don't believe that, but I'll tell you what's up right after this. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values, and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. Back in a big way. And I'd love to talk to you. My number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Interesting article here by Rick Moran and PJ Media about a 60-minute story that was done just recently on Navy UFO sightings. And it looks like the Pentagon's going to release a report about this, which I think would be something very interesting, no? The CBS News program, 60 Minutes, featured a report on regular sightings of unidentified aerial objects, UAPs. Just call them UFOs. It's easier. Everybody says UFO. Does anyone say UAP, unidentified aerial object? I don't think so. So sightings of UFOs by Navy pilots flying off the coast of Virginia. According to one Navy pilot, Ryan Graves, the objects were seen almost every day for several years and exhibited otherworldly characteristics in flight. Officer Graves says, he's a pilot. He's an officer, but he says, this is a difficult one to explain. You have rotation, you have high altitudes, you have propulsion, right? I don't know. I don't know what it is, frankly. And I understand rotation to mean, and all of you pilots out there, you can correct me if I'm wrong, and I might be wrong, but I understand rotation to be the movement of the plane as it's leaving the ground. So as the nose moves up, so you're heading down the runway, and for the plane to rotate means that it begins to rise into the air, the nose first, and then it glides up into the air. Maybe it means something different, but I think that's what it means. Luis Elizondo says he headed up the modern version of Project Blue Book at the Pentagon, the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, otherwise known as ATIP, A-A-T-I-P. It came into being following a 2004 encounter between Navy planes from the USS Nimitz and several objects resembling Tic Tac mints. It was the brainchild of former Nevada Senator Harry Reid and functioned as a clearinghouse for Navy sightings. Later, the program was tasked with investigating the phenomenon. The ATIP has since been replaced by the Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon Task Force. What does that add up to? UAPTF. Doesn't really roll off the tongue. There's no proof Elizondo ever worked in the government, which has made his claim suspect, but the UAP task force is real and is really working on getting answers. The investigation will culminate in a much-anticipated report to be released to the Senate in the month of June. UFO skeptics have been going through a lot of the evidence and discount the alien aircraft theories. So here's some instances of this, this from Skeptical Magazine. In fact, the only thing the Pentagon has admitted is that the videos are real and that they were taken by U.S. Navy personnel and not, therefore, fake CGI-generated videos or whatever, and that they were included in studies by the UAP task force, meaning that they were at least unidentified at one point. So the skeptics at Skeptical Magazine say, we are then shown two other videos. FLIR-1 is claimed to show physics-defying acceleration, but careful study has shown that the supposed sudden moves are actually the result of the camera moving or changing mode. Gimbal, which is the name of another video, shows an impressive-looking flying saucer, but again, the reality seems more mundane. An infrared glare of a distant plane and a rotating gimbal mechanism explain both the rotating saucer shape and why it was named gimbal in the first place. So I'm going to pause there. Whatever. I mean, I'm all in favor of debunking claims that can be debunked. If people are saying this is a miracle, and it's not a miracle, if it's really just some natural occurrence, let's debunk the miracle claim. It doesn't do anyone any good to believe in a fake miracle. If it is an artifact of light in a camera, or if it's some other naturally occurring phenomenon that would debunk the claim that this is a UFO, great, let's debunk it. It's in our best interest to debunk any claims that are not really what they purport to be. I think most people would agree with me. But here's a question that I have as I read through this the first time. How do you account for the fact that the pilots saw these things? They weren't, it wasn't like just what you see in the video. The video is what they fired up to capture what they were seeing, but they were seeing this with their own eyes in some cases. Now, is it possible that they were deceived by a trick of light or by shadows or by some possible, I suppose. But when you have so many of these sightings, hundreds, thousands of them, they're seeing something. And as pilots, I would think they would be in a better position than I am to determine, you know, whether or not something is aerodynamically possible, given the current state of the art of our advanced physics and what we can do with machinery. I mean, if they're seeing things that they can't account for, I think there's probably something there more than just flares of light on lenses and things. Skeptics can be accused, the article says, of many of the sins committed by UFO enthusiasts. Elizondo, for his part, he has a different take. He says, we're going through our due diligence. Is it some sort of new type of cruise missile technology that China has developed? Is it some sort of high-altitude balloon that's conducting reconnaissance? Ultimately, when you have exhausted all those what-ifs and you're still left with the fact that this is in our airspace and it's real, that's when it becomes compelling, and that's when it becomes problematic. The article points out that the problem the Pentagon has is to see if these objects are a threat. If they're not from another planet, then they are almost certainly from Russia or China, giving their aircraft a decided advantage over our most advanced fighters. And that Navy pilot, Graves, he says he knows what he saw and he's worried about it. He says, I'm worried, frankly. If these were tactical jets from another country that were hanging out up there, it would be a massive issue. But because it looks slightly different, we're not willing to actually look at the problem in the face. We're happy to just ignore the fact that these are out there watching us every day. So the Pentagon report, they say, is not likely to contain any bombshell videos or other evidence of extraterrestrial visitation, but at least it might allow us to begin asking better questions like, what are those things? Or what are they doing up there? So that takes me back to a comment that I made yesterday, just for what it's worth, for your good to know file. This is my take on it anyway. If there is any evidence that there is life on other planets, so maybe we'll find something on Mars. We're going all over Mars now. The Chinese just launched or just landed their rover on Mars in the last several days. We're up there. And if there's life, microbial life perhaps, or something more involved, that's going to be, I mean, it's obviously a huge moment in human history to discover life on another planet. If that happens, it may not happen. But if it happens, or if something far more dramatic were to happen and we do make contact with, or we clearly can identify that there are intelligent creatures from other places in the universe who are visiting us, what does that mean for your Christianity? Assuming you're Christian. I mean, if you're an atheist, it's just like, well, okay, science fiction time. But if you're a Christian, what does that mean for your Christian faith? Well, I already know what it means for me. And that is that it doesn't change anything. And the reason it doesn't change anything is because, by definition, God is the God of the universe. He created the universe and everything in it. Either he created it all at once, or he created things in secondary and tertiary ways. But ultimately, it all is traceable back to God. If there's a multiverse and there's trillions of other universes, doesn't change anything. Same thing. Same God who's in charge of all of that. So if it turns out that this, if it winds up that we do make some sort of contact and we say, well, got to rewrite the history books because this whole time they've been watching us, that won't shake my faith at all. And it shouldn't shake your faith. And if it happens, I want you to call me on the day that that happens. Hopefully I'll be on the air that day. And you know, when the headlines are blaring and, you know, the Drudge Report has that siren at the top of it spinning red and people are all freaking out, give me a call and we'll talk about it. And I'll talk you down, because it won't change anything. God is still the God of the universe and everything in it. Bruce in Lexington, Kentucky, thank you for waiting and welcome.
Yes, sir. On the topic of UFOs, there's a Christian physicist. He died a few years ago, Chuck Nessler. And I read one of his articles about 20 years ago. Title is UFOs and the Coming Great Deception.
Yeah.
I would encourage you, because you're a deep thinker, to look this up and look at it. It will explain, at least from his point of view, mm-hmm. and show a lot of graphics about these objects and his explanation of what they are. And also the fact that, you know, some of these are triangular, some are round, and some are cigar-shaped.
Mm-hmm.
He shows graphic examples of those. But to make a long story short, it's extraterrestrial
mm-hmm.
and in the spirit world. And the very fact that we're three dimensions and these extraterrestrials are 10-dimension. Now, extraterrestrials are anything in the spirit world.
Well, let's pause there for a second, Bruce. I'm glad you called and I'm glad you're raising this issue. I am familiar with Chuck Missler, and I did read, I think I did see a number of his videos. I didn't realize he had died. So that's interesting. And I'm familiar with his argument that this is a deception that's being perpetrated by demons who are masquerading as these UFOs. So I'm familiar with the thesis, and I have taken into account some of the things that he has said about that. He's not the only one. There were others as well. But for the purposes of our discussion, let's remember that extraterrestrial, it doesn't mean what I think you think it means. It sounds like a line from a movie, doesn't it? It means in this context that it's not from this planet. And the planet is known as Terra. That's, you know, the Latin word that we have adopted as the name for this planet. So Terra would be different from, say, Saturn or Jupiter or Mars or the Moon. So anything that's not on this planet, Terra, is extraterrestrial. It's on the Moon, or it's in space, or it's on some other planet. And in this context, that's what that's referring to. It doesn't refer to demons, because demons, remember, as fallen angels, they're pure spirits. They don't take up space. They don't They don't have a presence in the physical universe the way you and I do, because we are body and spirit. So I think it would be going too far to say that extraterrestrial equals everything in the spirit world. That's not what it means, with all due respect.
Yes, I probably have those words wrong. Wrongly, instead of extraterrestrial, probably multidimensional would be a better.
Yeah, there's another way to put it.
Description.
Yeah. So, what is your take on it, Bruce? Okay. I know that your time is probably short, but are you convinced that the so-called UFOs are actually demonic spirits?
Yes, I 100% do.
Yeah, I don't, but I'm willing to consider other information. But one reason that I don't accept that theory is that fallen angels do not need vehicles. They don't need spaceships. They don't need machinery. They can do what they do without any of that. They don't need any of that.
Well, I don't think that Chuck nor I, either one, believes that machinery is involved. It's whatever they're... I guess you can't use the word being since they're all spirit, but they're, you know, one of their dimensions, of which I guess Chuck and others believe there's 10 dimensions. One of their dimensions just happens to be visible in our three-dimensional realm at times. And why and how, we don't know, but that's at least his theory.
Yeah, you're right about that. That is his theory. I guess coming at it from maybe a more theological perspective, Bruce, I would posit that, I mean, certainly the demons can and want to mimic things that God can do. They can't really do those things, though. They can only do mimicry. But they're not in different dimensions. They're not in time and space the way we are. So if we think about three or four dimensions that we can experience, they're pure spirits. They exist outside of all that. Now, they can be made present to us by God's permission. You know, if a demon were to appear, it's only because God permitted it. But they're not changing from their dimension into ours. They're just being, we're allowed to see them for whatever reason, or vice versa. Well, anyway, I think we're sort of maybe at an impasse here, but I appreciate your thoughtful way of bringing this up, Bruce. I really do.
Can I expound on one more thing?
Sure.
It would really bother me if I found out that they are extraterrestrials and there is life forms on other, like ours, on other planets, because. Mm-hmm. I affirm, you know, there's no doubt that Jesus was the Son of God and he died for our sins and he came to this earth. Mm-hmm. And I would have a real hard time if there were beings on other planets. Of course, they were created by God, certainly.
What difficulty would that pose for you?
In all likelihood, they're going to go through other cultures, they're going to go through or whatever. Other planets of people are going to go through the same as us. I think everything in the universe is fallen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
that's true.
So would Christ die for them too? Or what's, I don't know. I just have a hard time. It's easier for me to believe in multidimensional than it is extraterrestrial, to be honest with you, from a faith standpoint.
Well, that's an intriguing question. I don't have time to offer a thought, but I'll do that on the other side of this timeout, Bruce. Thanks for that. Thanks for calling. I hope we get a chance to talk again. So keep listening, even after you hang up, and I'll offer a few thoughts on your point there. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. I'll be right back.
Hope restored. Hearts healed. Lives changed. Here's another Relevant Radio miracle moment.
Brian Gibson, our guest from Pro-Life Action Ministries. Brian, you were talking about in the course of the last, if I'm doing my math correctly, 9101 to the last 35, 36 years, you've saved 3,100 babies' lives, 113 just last year. Tell us about some of those success stories.
This couple drives up. And I could tell that they were looking to go to Planned Parenthood, but they had missed the driveway, so they pulled across the street in front of the library. So I walked very carefully across the street, very not wanting to look like I was rushing over there, and went over to the driver's side where the man was in the vehicle and offered him the information I had and a few kind words, and let him know we could help and he could talk to us anytime and things like that. And then I walked away to let that sink in. And they sat there for about 10 minutes. And then the car started moving to do a U-turn to come toward the driveway, and I'm going, oh no, they're going in. And of course, I'm praying like mad the whole time. And so they come around, and instead of going into the Planned Parenthood driveway, they stopped on the curb right in front of me, and passenger window goes down. The woman sitting in the passenger seat is just bawling her eyes out, and the man kind of leans past her to talk to me and says, thank you for being here. We didn't know what this really was. We cannot do this because you were here.
Wow.
And then they took further information on a nearby pregnancy help center and went.
This miracle moment was brought to you by you. Help inspire more miracles. Please call now with your tax-deductible donation. 1-877-291-0123. 1-877-291-0123. Or donate online at relevantradio.com.